Good evening, friends. Members of the Universal House of Justice, my colleagues at the International Teaching Center, my fellow staff members of the World Center, ladies and gentlemen, it is a privilege for me to welcome you all this evening to the launch of the Serving the Divine Plan program, which has been a source of joy and excitement for all of us since its announcement some 19 days ago. In light of the unique position of the Friends serving at the World Center and the intimate connection of their functions with the successful unfoldment of the global plan, the House of Justice announced the launch of this program in a letter of 9 October addressed to all of us. The Supreme Body stated in that letter that we, the friends who have the opportunity to serve here, can, I quote, acquire a broad perspective of the cause, and if properly prepared, can serve as a powerful reinforcement to the progress of the plan in diverse parts of the world. Further, the House of Justice wrote that, and I quote again, it is imperative for the friends here, especially for the short-term staff, to remain current with the learning that is taking place in the field, and to use the period of their service to strengthen their understanding of Baha'u'llah's vision for world order, and the part his followers are to play towards its realization. The program will consist of a series of talks and workshops and the study of the books of the Ruhi Institute. The talks will be held once a month in a Friday evening and workshops on the following Saturday. Participants who have not completed their study of the Ruhi Institute courses will take part in one of the many study circles that will be held in the intervening period. All the staff serving at the World Center are invited to attend the Friday talks and to join study circles. Short-term staff, those who have recently arrived and selected others, will be participating in the Saturday workshops as well. Of course, many long-term staff members will be supporting the program by acting as tutors of study circles or facilitators of workshops. Friends, to mark the launch of this program, a member of the Universal House of Justice, Dr. Peter Khan, is to make a presentation tonight on the subject of service and devotion. He has agreed in principle to my saying a few words about him before he speaks. As you would have expected, it has been somewhat difficult not only to determine how few is few, but also to select exactly which words and phrases are to comprise those few. I will try. Dr. Peter Khan was born in Australia and studied at the University of Sydney, where he obtained 2 bachelor's degrees in science and engineering, as well as a doctoral degree in electrical engineering. While in Australia, he served for 5 years as member of the National Spiritual Assembly. After his doctoral studies, he proceeded to the United States on a Fulbright scholarship as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan. He later continued working in this university as a professor of electrical engineering. While living in the United States, he was appointed as an auxiliary board member and served in this capacity until his return to Australia, where he was appointed to the Continental Board of Councillors in Australasia in 1976. Dr. Khan and his wife Janet transferred their residence in Israel in 1983 in view of his appointment to the International Teaching Center. and since March of 1987 has been serving as a member of the Universal House of Justice. A life member of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, Dr. Khan has also been serving in its editorial board for the journal Transactions on Microwave Theory. In 1999, he was a recipient of the Microwave Pioneer Award from the International Microwave Society for his research achievements in his professional field spanning several decades. Dr. Khan has lectured widely on a range of Baha'i subjects and has written numerous articles on the faith. He co-authored the book Advancement of Women, a Baha'i Perspective, with his wife, Dr. Janet Khan, who is also with us here tonight. Friends, please join me in welcoming our speaker for tonight, one who has been serving the faith and the larger society with distinction, as an engineer, a researcher, and a writer, as an administrator and an educator, and above all, simply as being your Baha'i friend and mine, Dr. Peter Khan.
Dear friends, some few years ago, I visited the city of Vancouver and was taken to one of the sites, one of the tourist sites on the north side of that city, the Capilano Salmon Fish Hatchery. And it is, as the name suggests, on straddles the Capilano River, and salmon, driven by an inner compulsion, proceed to swim up that river against a very fast-flowing current at a certain point in their lives. And one of the features of the Capilano Fish Hatchery is that it has what's called a fish ladder. And this consists of a series of platforms so that the struggles of the fish as it proceeds up the slope are aided by its ability to proceed from one small stage to the other till it traverses the slope. I mention this to you tonight because I see it as an appropriate metaphor for the challenge we Baha'is face in the practice of service and devotion in a secular society which is moving strongly in the other direction. In a real sense, we are swimming upstream against the flow of current. We cannot rest, we cannot relax, or we will be swept downward. If you visit the Capilano Fish Hatchery, you find that they have constructed a glass wall very, very close to this fish ladder so people can stand there and see right in front of them the tremendous struggle that the salmon have to put up to defeat the current and to proceed as their inner compulsion moves them. We are, as I say, in a similar situation. The society around us is, to a large extent, preoccupied with the quest for personal happiness through material goods, through the erroneous view that happiness is found by the accumulation of material possessions rather than, as we understand, through a commitment to the practice of spiritual values and practices. The social dimension of the world around us is that a society, be it local, national, or regional, can best find its security and strength through affluence, financial power, and military resources. All of this creates an ambience against which we must struggle, because our views are so very different. Nor can we find very much in the way of kinship with people of other religious persuasions. Conventionally, religion, to the extent that it is concerned with devotion, assigns it a place as an intrinsically solitary pursuit. Devotion is expressed alone, generally in isolation from the rest of society, or as a relatively passive participant in a congregation. The social dimension of service, conventionally in religion, is associated with doing good to others, but not within the context that our religion provides, that is service ultimately towards the rectification of the problems of the world, the creation of a new world order, and the construction of an ever-advancing civilization. This is a far more exalted goal, a far broader perspective. Abdu'l-Bahá, in one place, says, "Know that nothing will benefit thee in this life save supplication and invocation unto God, service in his vineyard, and with a heart full of love to be in constant servitude unto him." In that one sentence, Abdu'l-Bahá has encapsulated everything of which I will be speaking tonight. The categorical statement in our faith that nothing will benefit us save what Abdu'l-Bahá mentions, supplication and invocation unto God, service in his vineyard, and to be in a constant attitude of service towards him. My subject tonight, as Councillor Ramirez announced, is service and devotion. And one must well realize that these are two sides of the one coin. They interact, they interplay, one can make an arbitrary distinction between one and the other. Abdu'l-Bahá in Paris Talk says, "This is worship, to serve mankind and to minister to the needs of the people." He goes on to point out, service is prayer. It is in that sense that I recognize the artificiality of the distinction between service and devotion. Nevertheless, there are some important parameters which apply to one and to not the other, and I'll attempt to share my understanding on this subject with you this evening. Buried in these concepts of service and devotion in a Baha'i sense is a paradox. The fact that the concepts of which we speak are counterintuitive. We live in a society where one is enjoined to become strong, independent, to stand on one's own feet, to be not dependent upon others. And that, paradoxically, to a Baha'i, requires that we be subservient, that we express devotion, that we express attachment to an unknown higher power. A an attitude, a position, which might well be criticized as the very opposite of independence, of self-assurance, of standing on one's own feet, making one's own decisions. It is paradoxical that we see those as highly desirable qualities to be found through subservience to our Creator. In a society where the pursuit of individual happiness is of the greatest concern to the mass of the people, the paradox is that our faith tells us individual happiness is to be found through concern for the welfare of others. The exact opposite of the conclusion to which one might come from a superficial assessment. These are examples of a large number of paradoxes, counterintuitive statements that one finds in the Baha'i writings. Intrinsically, the obligatory prayer calls upon us to know the unknowable, to know God and to worship Him, and yet our faith tells us that God is unknowable in His essence. Many such paradoxes come to mind. In the book Advent of Divine Justice, Shoghi Effendi uses the word paradox, in which he describes the future of the nation of the United States, that its security will come, as he says, paradoxically, through a fuller involvement in the geopolitics of the larger society and, in fact, of the entire globe. And he calls attention to the paradox of that statement. Probably my favorite paradox is found in another place in Advent of Divine Justice, where Shoghi Effendi, and I quote, says to the Baha'is that ostracism is itself the magnetic power that must eventually win over to its, the Baha'is, camp, the most vociferous and inveterate among its foes. Again, totally counterintuitive. Who else would say that the ostracism of Baha'is or of a Baha'i community generates a magnetic power that wins over to the Baha'is their most inveterate and vociferous enemies? This multitude of paradoxes in our religion arises not from our forsaking logic and rationality, but rather from expanding its purview to include the larger forces, the larger dimensions of our society, the spiritual components of life. And if we do that, then the paradoxes are resolved. It seems to me that a deeper exploration of the concepts of service and devotion requires that we give attention to three fundamental issues. I want to go through each of these three in turn, and then I want to say some remarks more specifically about service and devotion. So, let me proceed to these three issues which I see as underlying the concepts of service and devotion, and in fact as underlying many, many aspects of the Baha'i teachings. The first of these issues is what I believe to be our limited knowledge of the universe. It is clear from the magnificent achievements in human understanding over the past 200 years, that there has been a tremendous increase in our knowledge of the universe over that period. We know a lot more than we did 200 years ago. We know about the concepts of forces and fields and their relationship. We have dissected to a phenomenal extent the subatomic structure of matter. We have gone beyond protons and neutrons and electrons to all kinds of other things, fermions, mesons, bosons, quarks, and the like. We have solved the fundamental issues associated with the structure of the DNA and the RNA molecules. In astrophysics, dwelling on this relatively small planet, we have succeeded in developing an understanding, firstly, of the structure of our galaxy and our position in it, then of the relationship of clusters of galaxies in the vast infinitude of space, the composition of other planets in our solar system, and more recently, the existence of planets in other systems of the galaxy. We have, to a large extent, succeeded in unifying the disparate disciplines of biology, chemistry, and physics. So it is quite appropriate that modern people feel that great discoveries have been made, great achievements have come about, and that we have a very impressive knowledge of the universe, how it works, how it functions, what it does, how it was made, and so on. But if we stop and think, there's a lot we don't know. And this is not necessarily immediately apparent when one reads in news media and the like of the achievements of science and of other disciplines. We don't know what is the nature of each of the building blocks of the universe. We don't know what mass is. We don't really know what energy is. We don't know what is electrical charge. We can manipulate equations. We can describe behavior with an intricate mathematical form, but we don't really know what it is about which we are speaking. We don't know what it is that propagates in space when we have energy transmission to distant parts of the universe. We don't know what is a vacuum. We know that there is a zero-point energy in vacuum. We know there are fluctuations of positrons and electrons, and that gives rise to a zero-point energy, but we don't know what is a vacuum. We don't know whether dark matter really exists out there in the universe and whether that is the explanation for some of the astrophysical questions that are otherwise unsolved. We assume that there's a great deal of dark matter out there to make all the equations balance, but we don't really know. We don't know how the universe evolved. The prevailing theory is that of the Big Bang, and that may or may not prove to be accurate, I don't know. But it still begs the question, what happened before the Big Bang, and how did it all come into being in this very concentrated point of mass that exploded with the Big Bang, and what happened? Does it keep expanding ad infinitum, or is there what scientists call a big crunch coming where the whole thing collapses on itself, and if so, what happens after that? We don't know what is the role of life in the universe. We have some reason to believe that it does propagate from one part of the universe to the other, perhaps through the media of comets, but we don't know what and how it is. There is an interesting principle called the anthropic principle, which has attracted a great deal of attention, which basically says that life is such that the parameters of the universe adjust to make life feasible. But that's still a theory. We don't know whether it's true or not, or whether it's part of a larger scheme. There are many other mysteries. We don't know why certain places feel different because they're sacred. We don't know why certain holy places in the world are such that if you go there, you feel different. You feel a sense of exaltation. You feel a sense of devotion just being there. We don't know what it is about those places. We can't explain it in terms of molecular structure or anything like that. Conversely, we don't know why some places feel terrible. I remember some years ago visiting the Museum of the Inquisition in Lima, Peru. And it was clear that in that relatively bare rooms of that museum, great suffering had occurred, and that people had experienced deep anguish, and that had changed something in the environment. That going into the Museum of the Inquisition, one felt agony, one felt great distress. The same applies in recent years where I visited Buchenwald concentration camp outside Weimar in Germany. And there's an area there where medical experiments were performed on the hapless inmates of the concentration camp while they were still alive and without anesthetic. And there again, that relatively bare setting, undistinguished in any other way, had a terrible feeling to it. We don't know what it is that creates that. There are, in addition, statements in the Baha'i writings which reinforce the concept that we don't know very much about the universe. For example, Abdu'l-Bahá, in a statement attributed to him in the book Divine Philosophy, refers to the development of life in other parts of the universe. He says, "The earth has its inhabitants. The water and the air contain living beings. How is it possible that these stupendous stellar bodies are not inhabited?" He says, "Verily they are peopled, but let it be known that the dwellers accord with the elements of their respective spheres. Those living beings do not have states of consciousness like those who live on the surface of this globe. The power of adaptation and environment molds their bodies and states of consciousness just as our bodies and minds are adapted to our planet." This is beyond the purview of present-day science, but no doubt it'll expand to encompass that. We don't know what the mechanism is. We don't know how living beings in other parts of the universe are adapted to the environmental conditions and the chemistry of those regions of the universe. Baha'u'llah has in several places in his writings referred to the human ability to transcend the time dimension, and we don't know very much about it. He refers to dreams. He says, "Behold how the dream thou hast dreamt is after the lapse of many years re-enacted before thine eyes. Consider how strange is the mystery of the world that appeared to thee in thy dream." And he goes on about it, but sufficient to make the point that he has demonstrated, called our attention to the ability of human beings to transcend the time dimension while essentially within this stage of our existence, and we don't know much about it. We don't know how to do this at will or whether we can or should or anything like that. Our Baha'i contribution to the knowledge of the universe centers around the existence, operation, and influence of spiritual forces which are not yet accepted by conventional thinking. This is our understanding. of the universe, and it is not incorporated in the conventional body of knowledge of the mass of the people of the world. Yet to us, it is a reality. It is part of the accurate description of the universe that there are spiritual forces. Our writings refer to this at great length. Baha'u'llah refers to the influence of an individual reciting the verses of God, and how, as you know from the introduction of the prayer book, the very familiar statement that the scattering angels will scatter it abroad. Shoghi Effendi, in Advent of Divine Justice, refers to what he calls the God-born force injected into the world with the coming of the Bab and Baha'u'llah, which is operating, as he quotes Baha'u'llah, within the inmost being of all created things, and its vibrating influence, as Baha'u'llah says, upset the equilibrium of the world and revolutionized its ordered life. We don't know very much about it other than what is in our writings. We don't know the mechanism by which it operates. We see the world's equilibrium sadly upset around us, but how it relates, what is the mechanism of the causative relationship between the coming of the twin manifestations, and that the details are beyond us at this point. Shoghi Effendi, in his writings, makes a number of profoundly mysterious statements about the spiritual dimension which is part of our existence. For example, he says in describing Mashriq al-Azkar to be built during the 10-year crusade, he said each of the three to be built at that time was, as he described, a house for the indwelling spirit of God. We don't know what it means. We don't know how it is that a Mashriq al-Azkar is a house for the indwelling spirit of God. We know it's true because the Guardian said so. This is all part of the mystery of the spiritual nature of, as an element of the universe, which is central to my thesis that we have a very limited knowledge of the universe. And I regard that as underlying the issue of devotion and service, because the precepts of devotion and service call upon us in many instances to do things which seem quite meaningless, but which are spiritually profound in consequence because of the spiritual forces. It's like the oft-repeated story of the visitor to the shrine of the Bab who was in a hurry, the bus was leaving, and this person came to the door of the shrine, that was the time when visitors could go in, and looked inside and said to their fellow tourists in the group, "It's okay, there's nothing in there." And that, to my mind, was quite a fascinating remark, because it was an example of the material perspective. And in a real sense, there is nothing in the shrine of the Bab you go in. It's an empty room. Just the prayers on the framed on the wall. Otherwise, it's empty. Some lights, some flowers, and things like that. Yet to us, people journey from distant parts of the globe to bow their forehead at the threshold with the certainty that there is something there and that great spiritual forces are at work. The second of the three principles which I believe underlie service and devotion is the interconnection between forces and processes in the universe. This derives from a profound philosophic statement of Abdu'l-Bahá. He says, and I quote, "Reflect upon the inner realities of the universe, the secret wisdoms involved, the enigmas, the interrelationships, the rules that govern all. For every part of the universe is connected with every other part by ties that are very powerful and admit of no imbalance nor any slackening whatever." And it is on the basis of that statement that I infer, the remark I make, that every part of the universe is interconnected with every other part to an extent far beyond our present-day comprehension. Some things are obvious. Some things we know about. We know about the effect of the moon. We know about lunar tides and their effect not simply on the movement of the water in the ocean, but physiologically. We know about circadian rhythms that affect the physiological operation of individuals over the course of a 24-hour period and beyond. We know there are all kinds of cycles in daily or life over a year and over several years, and sunspot cycles and their effect upon us. We know about that small things can, through interconnection, have a very large effect, the so-called butterfly effect, beloved of those who subscribe to the results of chaos theory, these kinds of things. We do know quite a bit about interconnections, but we don't know all we might. For example, in the Kitab-i Ikan, Baha'u'llah speaks of the signs that appear in the physical universe at the time of the coming of a manifestation. And with the Bab and Baha'u'llah, the thinking of Baha'is who've studied this is that it refers to Biela's comet. And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Nevertheless, the fundamental issue that arises is, how is it that a sign appears in the physical universe at the time of the coming of a manifestation? Do we reduce God to a magician playing tricks, firing out comets and errant asteroids or whatever because a manifestation of coming? This is a demeaning concept. It seems to me that a clearer view is that of the mystery of the interconnection of the physical and the spiritual in the universe. How do we explain the things that are in Dawnbreakers about what happened in Tabriz when the Bab was martyred? Do we reduce God to a vengeful creator who decides, okay, I'll give you a terrible windstorm and dust and darkness and all because you martyred the Bab? To me, that's demeaning. It is rather, I see in the record of that incident at Dawnbreakers with the martyrdom of the Bab an example of the mystery of the interconnection of the spiritual and the material in the universe. How do we explain the statement of Abdu'l-Bahá in the Tablet of Purity, where he says, even in the physical realm, cleanliness will conduce to spirituality, as the holy writings clearly state. Although bodily cleanliness is a physical thing, it has nevertheless a powerful influence on the life of the spirit. I submit this also as a further example of the mystery of the interconnection of what would otherwise appear to be disparate elements of the universe. At an initial reading, one might well say, why is this so? Why is it that cleanliness has an effect on spirituality? What is the operation of that? What are the mechanisms? How does it work? And at this stage, we can speculate, and there are all kinds of interesting speculations one could offer, but we don't really know at an intricate level. The interconnections described in our religion are multidimensional. Abdu'l-Bahá in Paris Talks speaks of the interaction between this world and the next. And Baha'u'llah refers to those who he describes who ascend to the next world with utmost purity and sanctity and with absolute detachment. And he says the light which these souls radiate is responsible for the progress of the world and the advancement of its peoples. How does that work? We don't know. He says they are like leaven, which leaveneth the world of being. They constitute the animating force through which the arts and wonders of the world are made manifest. This is true because Baha'u'llah said so, but we don't know how it works. But nevertheless, it is yet another example of the interaction between elements of the world in which we operate. What is the relevance of this to my subject of service and devotion? The relevance is simply the fact that, as we will see, service and devotion both have multiple components. And it seems to me that these multiple components interact. They cannot be addressed sequentially. You can't say, well, I'll work on this little bit of devotion for the next few weeks, and when I get that under control, then I'll take another little piece of it and I'll work on it after that. Everything relates to everything else. Everything is interconnected. Our commitment to service and devotion ultimately is holistic and involves a total commitment to a way of life, to a variety of actions and attitudes which are united in our belief and our acceptance of the revelation of Baha'u'llah. The third principle or issue that I want to mention is this, that it seems to me that one of the features of the universe is that small actions can, under certain circumstances, lead to very large consequences. Small things which seem relatively inconsequential can, under certain circumstances, have vast consequences. In the year 1636, the good people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts decided that they needed to provide for the education of promising young people. They paid for the wages of a person who was designated as a schoolmaster, and they gathered 9 promising students, gave him a classroom, and said, go to it and teach these children. They acquired a library left to them by a generous benefactor, and that was the beginning of Harvard University, which is, I think, well accepted as one of the great universities of the world. And I say to myself, who at that time in 1636 in Boston, in the metropolitan area of Boston, would have thought that this simple act of gathering 9 promising students and hiring a schoolmaster would, over the course of time, lead to one of the greatest institutions of learning in the world? And I say that because I look today and see our modest, promising institutes in different parts of the world, our study circles, our distance learning concepts, and who among us can imagine where they will be in 200 years' time. In 1897, in the city of Lansing in Michigan, a gentleman called Ransom Olds worked for his father in a little kind of blacksmith shop in Lansing, and he decided that he could get a rudimentary gasoline engine or petrol engine and attach it to a box-like structure. In fact, it looked more like a bathtub from what I've seen, and put 4 wheels on it, and he called it a vehicle. He tried to sell it to the unsuspecting people of Michigan. He managed to sell 4 of the vehicles in 1 year, and it's kind of a miracle that he did so. That is the beginning of the General Motors Corporation. Olds flourished. He called his vehicle Oldsmobile, a natural modesty sort of thing, and later it grew by acquisitions and mergers and the like, and now we have one of the largest corporations in the world from the General Motors Corporation. It happens again and again that small things lead to large consequences. When I was functioning in the scientific community in the United States in the early 1960s, one of the things that was kind of a joke around the place was that one of the members of the scientific community had found a way to get amplification of light by the stimulated emission of radiation. And this was a nice scientific curiosity. He had to call it something, so he took the letters and made an acronym and called it the laser. And the laser is light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And it was regarded as a joke through most of the 1960s, and these poor people who were working on laser and refinement and all would go to scientific conferences and would have to endure the misplaced humor of their compatriots who described the laser as an answer looking for a question. Because that's what it was. People thought, how wonderful it is that you've produced coherent light. What do we do with it now? And for many years, if you review the scientific literature of that period, nobody knew what to do with lasers. The graduate students found ways of refining it, and it was a source of doctoral theses, but that was as far as it went. Who could have predicted that years later, CDs, CD players, DVD players, the whole technology of optical communications and the like, and all the things that go along with that, could have derived from that invention? Certainly those who were responsible for it had no idea of the scope of the laser to transform society and its communications and signal processing and computing and the like. We find this in this same principle of small actions giving rise to large effects. We find it also in the Baha'i writings to a great extent. Baha'u'llah says, one righteous act is endowed with a potency that can so elevate the dust as to cause it to pass beyond the heaven of heavens. And Abdu'l-Bahá, in encouraging the believers in the early days of the faith, in the latter part of the heroic age, we find his statements where he calls upon them to make a start. He says in referring to the initial efforts for the construction of the Mashriq al-Azkar in Wilmette, he said, you have only to begin, everything will be all right. And that, to my mind, summarizes what we're talking about in this issue. Make a start, everything will be all right if it's operating in accord with the forces and predispositions of the universe. Shoghi Effendi designated the first heroic pioneers to a continental or national region of the world. He said they were the spiritual conqueror of that country. Yet it was an individual who lived and died without much apparent effect, unknown. Very few, if any, people joined the faith. Very hard going, a great deal of suffering and frustration and disappointment. And one without such a phrase might well have looked upon such a life as essentially unsuccessful. This poor soul went off to a distant country, couldn't speak the language, poor as a church mouse, somehow survived, but nothing much happened. No, they were the spiritual conqueror of that country or even of that continental area. Small things can, under appropriate conditions, have a very large effect. This is found further in the unusual manner in which our writings refer to administrative institutions. For example, the local spiritual assembly is described as shining lamps and heavenly gardens. The lights of knowledge are spread abroad over all created things. The spirit of life streameth in every direction. And that is a description of an institution that comes into being, often in parts of the world where one manages through various means, hopefully legitimate, to round up 9 individuals and get them in some kind of proximity, one with the other, and go through the mysterious rites of electing a local spiritual assembly. And one might well imagine, and in fact I've probably been in that situation myself in decades past, where one sits there looking at one's other equally tired and somewhat despondent colleagues on the local assembly and says to oneself, is this really true? Is it so that the spirit of life is streaming in every direction? Is this really a potent source of the progress of man? And in fact, it is. It's not apparent. It may not be apparent for quite some time until the dispensation proceeds, but we know it is, and we know that's true, because small beginnings can have a vast effect when they're in conformity with the laws of the universe. We have present tonight the members of the International Teaching Center. When it was formed, the House of Justice described the International Teaching Center as destined to evolve into one of those world-shaking, world-embracing, world-directing administrative institutions, ordained by Baha'u'llah, anticipated by Abdul Baha, elucidated by Shoghi Effendi. I think it's very fair of me to say, although I'm not empowered to do so on behalf of the House of Justice, that the House of Justice takes immense pleasure and delight in the vitality and the energy and the actions of the International Teaching Center. But can we accurately, without reference to spiritual forces, say that that institution is world-shaking, world-embracing, world-directing? Rather, it is a reference to the enormous potential which that body will continue to manifest as it evolves and develops over decades and centuries to come. And people will look back and see that from its humble beginnings in 1973, it has proceeded from what seemed a very small, relatively inconsequential action when the individuals who were the members of the International Teaching Center of that time gathered, joined the members of the House of Justice, went to the holy shrines, had their prayers, and held their first meeting. Could one, without reference to the potential described in the writings, have at that time described it as world-shaking, world-embracing, world-directing? So again, the point is small beginnings can have an enormous effect. This has direct relevance to our subject tonight of service and devotion, because so many of the actions of service and devotion prescribed in our writings are small and apparently inconsequential. Recitation of the obligatory prayer, acts of kindness, acts of goodwill towards others who are in distress, may be unknown, may be unremarked upon by anybody else, may be unappreciated by the recipient. Yet we know from the model of the universe described in our faith that these apparently small actions can be ultimately unlimited in their consequence. This brings me to the final part of my presentation tonight. I want to focus somewhat more specifically, briefly, on devotion and on sacrifice. And there are some different features that I see in these, comparing one to the other. Devotion seems to me intrinsically to be multifaceted, centered around the expression of the worship of God in attitudes, statements, and daily actions, covering a wide spectrum. Obviously, it includes prayerful expressions. It includes formal statements of prayer, including, of course, the obligatory prayers. But prayerful expressions seem to me to go beyond that. That the prayerful expression of devotion embraces an appreciation of what is sacred, an appreciation that certain locations and certain objects are sacred and have to be treated differently. Obviously, it's very crucial to us because we dwell on God's holy mountain. We are surrounded by holy places. It is almost mundane for us to visit them and to carry out various activities on sacred locations. We are therefore challenged to rise to a perception of what is sacred and to determine what should be our appropriate conduct in a sacred location as distinct from a mundane, or, hesitates to use the word profane, location. It also challenges us to deal with the difficult question of how to show reverence. It's very easy to show reverence if you are prepared to forsake sincerity for ritual. Anybody can adopt the rituals of reverence, and it can often be very impressive and excite admiration and envy from others around you. But whether it's sincere or not is probably known only to the individual and to God. Our challenge is with our variety of cultures to express reverence in a sincere, non-hypocritical manner. It seems to me that devotion extends beyond these prayerful expressions. I see devotion as also expressed in one's attitude to the various elements of creation. One's attitude to other people, I see as part of devotion to God. The way one treats others in daily intercourse, in the expression of the respect for their rights, their feelings, their sensitivities, their capacity to experience hurt, rejection, and disappointment. I see devotion expressed, as stated by Baha'u'llah in the Kitab-i Iqan, in something as relatively mundane as kindness to animals, which Baha'u'llah refers to very specifically in that book. I see our treatment of animals as an expression of our devotion to God. This doesn't mean we all have to become vegetarian and swear off meat or anything like that, but I think the attitude of kindness to animals is an element of devotion. It also is expressed in our attitude to the environment around us, our appreciation of the wonder, the inspiration to be derived from the contemplation of the environment, our recognition of the beauty inherent in God's creation, in the environment, in beautiful scenery, in the various wonders of the environment that we perceive. Beyond that, my feeling is that devotion is also expressed in our attitude to ourselves as much as in our attitude to other people. The commitment of each individual to the acquisition of spiritual characteristics and virtues, to my mind, is an element of devotion. Some elements of devotion are fairly apparent in relation to oneself, in terms of, say, acquisition of moral qualities and the like. Some are very unusual. One of the unusual ones is explained by Abdu'l-Bahá. He says, in accordance with the divine teachings, the acquisition of sciences and the perfection of arts are considered acts of worship. If a man engages with all his power in the acquisition of a science or in the perfection of an art, it's as if he'd been worshipping God in churches and temples. And likewise, he says similar remarks about craftsmanship. In this universal dispensation, man's wondrous craftsmanship is reckoned as worship of the resplendent beauty. And he goes on to point out, in former times, such skills were regarded as tantamount to ignorance. So he's correcting a gross misapprehension. Finally, let me conclude with some remarks about service. There are a great many passages, as you well realize, in our authoritative writings which refer to the supreme importance of service. In Secret of Divine Civilization, Abdu'l-Bahá says, the highest righteousness of all is for blessed souls to take hold of the hands of the helpless and deliver them out of ignorance and abasement and poverty. We who are at the world center, where we are essentially a community composed almost entirely or entirely of Baha'is, friends of each other, find special relevance in a statement of Abdu'l-Bahá in which he says, service to the friends is service to the kingdom of God. Consideration shown to the poor is one of the greatest teachings of God. And this has a dual application. We're all the friends, and with the nature of World Center allowances, we're all poor. Within the context of service, our writings make clear that service to the advancement of the cause of God is of the highest priority. We have to distinguish between priority and exclusivity. It doesn't mean we neglect works of the immediate amelioration of poverty. The institutions of the faith have made contributions to the earthquake in Kashmir and to the tsunami in Southeast Asia, in Aceh and the like, and to the effects of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in the southeastern United States. We do regard it as important that our service embraces direct acts for the relief of suffering. But Shoghi Effendi has made it very clear repeatedly, and this is only one passage where he says, the greatest service Baha'is can render their countrymen, and indeed the whole of suffering mankind, is to pursue confidently and uninterruptedly the task of establishing the faith of the Father among all men. And he describes that as the greatest service. Again, not exclusivity, but certainly priority. Finally, or getting toward almost the final point I want to make, I want to draw your attention to the fact that this service may in many instances be unglamorous or even distasteful. Let me share with you a passage you may well be familiar with already, written by Howard Colby Ives, an early American Baha'i, concerning the visit of Leua Getzinger to Abdu'l-Bahá in Acre. It's a little longer than one might want at this time of night, but let me read anyhow. In the very early days of the knowledge of the cause of Baha'u'llah in America, Mrs. Getzinger was in Acre, having made pilgrimage to the prison city to see the master. She was with him one day when he said to her he was too busy today to call on a friend of his who was very ill and poor. He wished her to go in his place, take him food and care for him as I have been doing, he concluded. He told her where this man was to be found, and she went gladly, proud that Abdu'l-Bahá should trust her with this mission. She returned quickly. Master, she exclaimed, surely you cannot realize to what a terrible place you sent me. I almost fainted from the awful stench, the filthy rooms, the degrading condition of that man and his house. I fled lest I contract some terrible disease. Sadly and sternly, Abdu'l-Bahá regarded her. Dost thou desire to serve God, he said. Serve thy fellow man, for in him thou dost see the image and likeness of God. He told her to go back to this man's house. If it is filthy, she should clean it. If this brother of yours is dirty, bathe him. If he's hungry, feed him. Do not return until this is done. Many times had he done this for him. Cannot she serve him once? And I mention this because I use it to reinforce my point that we may all, in a fit of exaltation and emotion and adrenaline flowing and the like, commit ourselves with great vigor and energy to service. But let us at the same time remember that it may involve things you don't particularly want to do, things that are unglamorous, things that are distasteful, things that are boring, things that are routine, things that nobody will know anything about. Nevertheless, that seems to be the path of service to which Abdu'l-Bahá calls us. I conclude my presentation with a short passage from Abdu'l-Bahá, which I find to be at one and the same time inspiring and frightening. Abdu'l-Bahá said, among those who visit Acre, some have made great forward strides. Lightless candles, they were set alight. Withered, they began to bloom. Dead, they were recalled to life and went home with tidings of great joy. But others, in truth, have simply passed through. They've only taken a tour. Let us pray that it will not be said of us that our period of service in the Holy Land was such that we have simply taken a tour.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Khan, for the generous thoughts that you have shared with us. Very profound, and as you said, sometimes inspiring but frightening. Dear friends, with Dr. Khan's thought-provoking presentation, we have just completed the launch of the Serving the Divine Plan program. It is hoped that tonight's affair and the year-long cycle, if I may be permitted to say so, of the Serving the Divine Plan program will provide each one of us of adequate learning and experiences to enable us to be counted among the loved ones of Baha, for whom Abdu'l-Bahá has constantly prayed, saying that they may be enabled to hear the hidden truths that are written and embedded in the heart of all that is. To be leaders unto thee, guides unto thy path, runners urging men unto thy kingdom, wherever, as the Supreme Body's letter stated, the hand of providence may eventually lead us. At this point, I'm pleased to share with you an overview of the activities for tomorrow. For those who are participating in the workshops, the sessions will begin here in this building at 8:30 in the morning. Those attending the workshop on the dispensation of Baha'u'llah to be conducted by Mr. Hooper Dunbar should come to this auditorium, even though the schedule indicates the dining room. The other workshop on the fundamental concepts of the global plans to be conducted by Dr. Feridun Jabaheri will be held in the multipurpose room on level 6 of this building. The participants of this latter workshop will have to bring their book 1 copy with them. And good news, a light lunch will be provided to all the participants, so there will be no need for you to bring anything to eat. Now for next month, we will all come back here in the evening of Friday, 25th of November, when Mr. Paul Lampol speaks to us on the subject of knowledge. Let us now have the closing prayer, after which everyone is invited to the dining room for refreshments. Thank you and good night.
Army of God, the time hath come for the effects and perfections of the Most Great Name to be made manifest in this excellent age, so as to establish beyond any doubt that this era is the era of Baha'u'llah, and this age is distinguished above all other ages. O Army of God, whensoever ye behold a person whose entire attention is directed toward the cause of God, whose only aim is this, to make the word of God to take effect, who, day and night, with pure intent, is rendering service to the cause, from whose behavior not the slightest trace of egotism or private motives is discerned, who, rather, wandereth distracted in the wilderness of the love of God and drinketh only from the cup of the knowledge of God and is utterly engrossed in spreading the sweet savors of God and is enamored of the holy verses of the kingdom of God. Know ye for a certainty that this individual will be supported and reinforced by heaven, that, like unto the morning star, he will forever gleam brightly out of the skies of eternal grace.